My name is Christina O'Donnell, and I'm the communications director at the Dublin Institute. And I love economists. I'm married to one. There's an esteemed economist on our panel, but he's not the one I'm married to. My stepson is studying economics at university, so did my brother. And when we are around the dinner table, they are not full. They have reached equilibrium. When we're discussing our Christmas presents, we are discussing them in terms of Pareto optimability. Yes. And when my stepson cleans his room, it's been tidied on a macro level. What I'm trying to say with these suboptimal jokes is that economic jargon doesn't fit a domestic household, nor does gross domestic product fully convey what prosperity means. That is our approach at the Legato Institute with our signature annual publication, the Prosperity Index, which is coming out on the 4th of November. And it is our approach today with our panel, whom we have asked to look beyond GDP, at those policies that the tools could draw in 2013 to deliver greater prosperity. On our panel are Lord Adebawale, he claims he wasn't one of the first people's peers, but I know from Wikipedia he was. he is also the CEO of Turnpoint. We have Damian Green, who has been the distinguished Member of Parliament for Ashford since 1997. And was Minister until recently of Policing, Criminal Justice and Victims. We have Sean Worth, who was an indispensable special advisor to Number 10 and was charged by the Prime Minister to think the unthinkable and certainly say the unsayable about NHS privatisation. We also have Timmy Gunn, a legend among Tory faithful for having founded Conservative plan, and it pains me to say, as a Daily Telegraph writer, for writing an unmissable column in the Times. Our moderator is James Barty, who is special advisor to the government.
Good afternoon. The title of today's panel is Beyond GDP, the Roots of True Prosperity. We have a fantastic panel here, so I'm just going to give you a very brief run through of what we do at the Glass About Prosperity. And it was very interesting that one of the first comments out of George Osborne today was that he said he wants Britain, to quote, be quote unquote, to be the most prosperous country on earth. So, the way I think about the first term of this government, it was about righting the ship, it was about repairing the damage. And really now we're looking forward to the next term. And the key question for me is how do we make Britain prosperous? In terms of the way it gets looked at Legatum, this Prosperity Index, I'll give a very brief run through, that's going to be published in November. The whole idea is that being prosperous is not just about having good economic growth. So it looks at the economy, it looks at entrepreneurship and opportunity, governance, education, health, personal freedom, safety and security, and social capital. So you're incorporating a mixture of traditional economic indicators alongside measurements of well-being and life satisfaction. Now, put this in context for the UK, and you've got the sheet in front of you. Last year, the UK ranked 16th globally, so George Osborne's got a little bit of a way to go if we're going to get to number one. It scored well in areas like entrepreneurship, governance, personal freedom, but it lagged behind on the economy and education. Obviously those two elements are two which the current government are focused on for very good reason over the course of this Parliament. And without giving too much away about our prospective release, the UK is actually doing slightly better this year. It's doing slightly better on the economy, it's doing slightly better in areas of entrepreneurship. Interestingly, one of the measures that we use on entrepreneurship is the amount and speed of internet connection, and we do pretty well on that front too. But there's much to be done if we're going to get the UK up to the top. So what I want to do now is invite these gentlemen to tell us how we can make the UK more prosperous. They've got about 5 minutes each, and then we're going to open up to questions. And Sean's kindly agreed to kick off first.
Thank you very much. I guess I'll talk about the UK context mainly because I don't know much about any other. But in terms of policy making, there are usually sort of two things you think of in terms of prosperity from a policymaker's point of view. One is the concept of it and what it means and all the rest of it. And that's why, if I may say, the Gartam's work, you know, really, really important, because not many people actually focus on prosperity. There's a lot of work on poverty. It's often the mirror image, actually, the absence of poverty. But not many people kind of really unpick it, try and conceptualise what it means and why we value it. So, you know, it's really important that somebody is doing that work, because government certainly doesn't do it. Secondly is the sort of so what factor. So once you understand it, what on earth do we do about it? And from a government point of view, I guess on a policy level, it's how do we make sure that people can share in a prosperous society that we want to create. And it's this that second point that I'll talk very briefly about. Government's focus, again, just on the UK context, government's focus has for a long time been on poverty. Quite rightly, because it's the most visible kind of problem they've got. But in that area, sort of looking at poverty, how you help people escape it, what opportunities people have got, therefore how do we kind of create a society where people can share in prosperity. I think this is actually one of the biggest problems we've got in the UK today, and this is an issue that really hasn't been cracked. And I've just got a couple of brief thoughts about what I think the problem is and how we might go about dealing with it. It came to me, I've worked in government on social policy, not just health, but on other areas of policy as well. And I remember at the time, it was about 2012, the OECD published a bit of work. It's not perfect. It's a very sort of, it's once every 4 years they do a thing on social mobility. They look at all the countries and say, if you're a poor child born, if you're a child born to a poor family, what is your chance of escaping it in all these different countries? And there was hardly any news cover. I don't think there was any news coverage of it at all. But the UK came, I think it was actually at the bottom in the developed world, or right near the bottom. You know, almost unbelievable, given where we are, who we are, given that the government spends such an enormous amount of effort, not just money, in providing services to people which are supposed to be about creating opportunities. And that really kind of struck home to me that our whole approach in this country, where thinking about poverty in particular as well as prosperity, where our whole approach to kind of dealing with poverty is about, you know, the state and about government, what government can do. Universal entitlements are often seen as the only way you guarantee a kind of fair society. But what kind of society have we had? We've had I'm being party political here, but under the last Labour government, I remember right at the end of their term of office, income inequality was its highest ever, family breakdown was its highest ever, we had tons and tons of people lacking basic skills to get a decent job. You know, there was such a massive job to deal with, and that was after all that time and all that money. So what on earth has been going wrong? And I'll finish on this few thoughts. And this is the issue, I think, where we really need to start thinking really radically. And I think it does start with work like Garton's doing. You know, you've got to work out what on earth you're talking about first before you start to put policies in place to deal with it. But we really need to start being radical. And I'm eternally depressed by the debate we have in education, for example, where it's somehow seen as controversial to have free schools. You know, the concept of free schools where you allow parents and community groups to come together, set up a school, because the ones in their local area, frankly, they're deeply unhappy with. And yet there's some massive controversy with trade unions campaigning outside their door about it. What on earth are we, you know, I just can't get my head around it. It's exactly the same NHS, you know, the idea that we should be saying to people, who is best placed, who is the best person to provide, you know, hip operations? Is it Victor's organisation, or is it the state, or is it another one? Who cares? As long as the people can get access to that service, they're not going to take it away or sell it or anything like that. The people that provide it should be those that can do it best. And it's a very, very simple point, but it's those kinds of policies, which to me seem to be no-brainers and very, very basic, that we're not even at the point of having a serious and grown-up discussion about yet. So my final thought is, I think that, you know, and I said I think this is one of our biggest problems. In the next election, whoever wins, we know there's going to be a big drive for further spending cuts. George Osborne talked about today that we've only done 44% of the cuts so far. So there's more than half to go. You've got to start thinking completely outside the box if you're going to manage a society which can provide opportunities, schools, decent healthcare, the kinds of things I think that Legatum are focusing on as essential for prosperity. If we're going to have a hope of creating a society where we can provide things that to help people share in prosperity, we really start needing to have a grown-up discussion about how we can make some pretty fundamental changes to our whole approach, not just some of the policies there. I'll finish on that point. Thank you.
Thanks, Sean. Damien.
Thanks, James. And thanks to Legatum for bringing us together. It's a fascinating subject. Those who, like me, have been coming to this conference for many years and will remember the old-style conference, will remember the way people used to get called when there were proper debates at conference was to announce that you opposed the motion because it didn't go far enough. And I'm slightly going to do the same thing here, in that as the first thing, just to be difficult, is to say that if we absolutely go beyond GDP in analysing what makes a prosperous country and particularly what provides long-term prosperity, but we shouldn't neglect GDP altogether. That basic economic growth is a very, very important part that underpins many of the other types of prosperity that this very interesting index measures. So, and it's easier to promote general well-being, to use that particular phrase, if you're secure in your standard of living. Of course, money doesn't make you happy, but fear and insecurity make you unhappy, and lack of money makes you fearful and insecure. So I think that has to underpin any measure of prosperity. And the only route to ever higher prosperity, and therefore security, and indeed the chance to spread that prosperity among people who don't benefit, because the distribution of prosperity is as important as the collection of prosperity or the creation of prosperity, and the route to it is higher productivity, essentially boiling years of economic theory down to a simple proposition. And one of the numbers that we suffer from in this country is that by international standards we are very unproductive. It is extraordinary given the amount of investment we make both in education and in raising standards in the workforce and in other kinds of capital investment, we are still not as productive as the French. Broadly speaking, the French can get away with working a 35-hour week and having two-hour lunches and things like that because each of their individual workers are more productive than each of our individual workers. So we all work 60-hour weeks and we've got a more flexible economy and a million things are better economically in this country than they are in France. But nevertheless, they are, broadly speaking, about as rich as we are. And I know they're going through a horrendous economic crisis at the moment, but if you look over time, the French are, roughly speaking, as rich as we are while working a lot less hard. And there are two things we need to address on that. One is the tail in our education. By tail, I mean the bottom end of academic achievers, because we do tremendously well by children who are reasonably bright, both in the private and public sectors in this country. But for decades, in fact, since the Second World War, we have done much less well by children who are less bright. And that's what brings down our productivity figures. That's why British workers are relatively unproductive. And Michael Gove's reforms are absolutely necessary as a start, but they absolutely need to be carried on with. And I agree with Sean, there is room for more radical thinking in that space and taking on traditional the education establishment. And the second one I would point to is infrastructure and particularly transport. It is quite extraordinary how bad we are at keeping up continuous investment in our rail and in particular our road network. It is just not consonant with being an advanced society, and certainly not with the Chancellor's ambition of making us the most prosperous country in the world. That, frankly, for my entire adult lifetime, driving to and from Birmingham from London has been a misery. You assume that the M6 is going to be blocked at some stage, and really, those are the two biggest cities in England. Really, we ought to be able to connect, and they're not that far apart. That's a nonsense. So we need to do more about that. We particularly need to do more outside London. The Treasury rules militate against this because the Treasury applies cost-benefit analysis to every big transport project. And just because so many people already live in London and so many other people want to travel into London, it's always easier to produce good cost-benefit analysis for projects in London than projects elsewhere. That's why we're building Crossrail. We're not yet building all the things that George Osborne rightly wants to build in the north. So I think we will have to take on the Treasury theology to cope with the infrastructure problem. So those are, if you like, two challenges to the premise. But I do basically accept the premise that prosperity needs to be measured in different ways. And actually, the individual measures, the things that are on your seats, are fascinating. From my own experience, I was... when I first became police minister, the first speech they handed me contained the phrase you will have all have heard politicians use a lot, which is our police are the best in the world. And I've heard the Home Secretary say it, I've heard the Prime Minister say it, and I said, being fundamentally awkward, what's the evidence for this? How do we measure it? Do we have less crime than anywhere else? Do we solve a higher percentage of crime? Do we have higher public confidence in the police than anywhere else in the world? And the answer to all those questions is no. There is not actually a shred of evidence that the British police are the best in the world. We're not bad. When I said, go away and find me some evidence one way or the other, and they came back, and there's been a European study in which we're ninth. We have that was public confidence in the police. But I tell that anecdote as an illustration, actually measuring things that we all sort of think are true and indeed repeat to each other and accept are true is extremely important, because very often they aren't true. And actually having the basic information to measure how prosperous we are as a society must be the first step towards being able to address the problems that stop us being the most prosperous nation in the world in this wider sense. I would focus on two policies which get massively underreported and underpublicised by us Conservatives, which I think we really ought to talk about more, because they do contribute to non-economic prosperity. The first is the massive uptake of volunteering, and specifically the National Citizen Service, which allows disadvantaged young people to do something structured, to do something useful, often in their summer holidays, which does fantastic things completely below the radar all over the country. It's a very, very good policy, which I can tell from blank faces in front of you, none of you have ever heard of. It's a really, really good policy, and it does precisely the things that don't show up in the GDP figures, but actually make us a better society. And the second policy in the same vein is the Troubled Families Initiative. We're trying to take a couple of 100,000 of the most troublesome families, treat them not just with the welfare system treating them, at the same time as the police are dealing with them, at the same time as the school system is trying to deal with the truanting children and so on. Just say, this is a family. This family is causing huge amounts of trouble and huge amounts of misery around various parts of the system. Let's treat them as a family and get to the roots of the problem. Now, it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be quick. At the moment, it's just an overhead. But the vast majority of crime, for example, to revert again to my own experience, is, as police minister rather than as a criminal, the vast majority of crime is committed by a very, very small number of criminals. And most of them will come from these troubled families. If you can solve the troubled families at the start, then down the line, you're going to be able to keep cutting the police budget, because there'll be less crime. So we'll need fewer police officers. So that, I think, is a really important policy. And one more thought for the future is that if we want to have a prosperous society in a wider sense, we have got to think very hard about how we treat carers. There are 6.5 million people caring for someone else at the moment, whether it's an elderly relative, often it's children looking after parents with problems as well. And on top of that 6.5 million, 6,000 new people start being a carer every day. And most of them, of course, do it because they are helping their loved ones. And all they want is advice, support, and occasional respite. But we sort of ignore this at our peril. We will get to a tipping point where we won't be able to rely on all these people all of the time. And I do think we need some policies on that. And my very final thought is that each of these of the good policies are led by society and not necessarily by the state. So it absolutely fits in with wider conservative philosophy that this is a way to promote prosperity without just expanding the power and the economic demands of the state. Thank you.
Fantastic, thank you. There's actually quite a lot of what Damien talked about there actually that we encompass in the prosperity index, but given we're tight for time, Lord Edward Wiley.
Victor will do Victor. Nicely. I don't know what the Lord thing is. I always think people... Well, I suppose I'm amongst friends, so you can all refer to me as Professor Lord Victor Adibowale, if you want, but Victor will do nicely. This is very good. I like this, and I'm struck by the prosperity stuff because we do need some, don't we? So I guess my views are I'm not an economist either, nor am I a politician particularly. I'm a crossbench peer, so I have fun slagging them all off, really, to be honest. But there's a couple of things that I would say. The first is that, you know, if we are going to, and this is kind of links on to both Sean and Damien's point, if we carry on doing the same things, don't be surprised if we get the same results. So the definition of madness is to continue to do something that you know is doing you harm. And I guess it goes to the heart of what we consider to be politics in this country, you know, left or right, radical. Radical thoughts, ideas don't have to be the left or right. They just need to work. So I think the idea of prosperity, it's kind of obvious, really. You know, you can't really have a prosperous country that is separated by those who have and those who don't. It doesn't really matter whether you're left or right. It's not prosperous. The more the distinction that you know... sooner or later, that undermines the societal infrastructure. I mean, I don't want to live. My family came from Nigeria in 1950 something, not least because Nigeria is not a very equal country. We don't want to go there, do we? And you could argue that Nigeria is the very definition of the not a trickle down economy. So we have a problem, and I think that we're going to need some radical solutions really radical. So let me give you an idea of what I think that might be. So I'm really interested in the future of public services. I don't like the term, actually, because it's kind of, when you think of public services, you get into this debate about how much we're spending on this, that, or the other, and I'm sure that everybody wants to reduce public spending and all that. Wonderful. Unfortunately, I think we've had a couple of shocks that have reminded us that the term public services is pretty meaningless. So I have to talk about services to the public, within which I include banks and Tesco's, oddly enough, because we still have this idea of public service and services to the public that we had in 1930 freezing to death. Things have changed, people have changed, demographics have changed, needs and expectations have changed, and ideas of what constitutes a service to the public haven't. They haven't, and I think we need to shift that, because it's only by doing that we're going to respond to the actual needs of people, as opposed to the rhetoric of political ideology. We need a new settlement, basically, as to what services to the public should and need to be. And for me, that's a lot to do with collaboration across sectors. Sean mentioned the NHS, and I provide a service in partnership with the NHS, and it's interesting that this talked a lot about perception, and it's interesting at the AGM of NHS England, there were lots of people carrying banners about privatisation, and they believe that the government is privatising the NHS. You know, it's not for me to argue with them. Belief is everything, isn't it? And I pointed out to them afterwards that under the last government, the amount of health provided by private sector for-profit companies was 5%. And I said, well, how much do you think of it's been provided by under the current government? And they said, well, it's terrible, it's about 50%. I said, no, it's exactly 6.1%. It's made a difference of 1.6%. The point is that perception is a huge factor. People are not educated to think through, and they're given these right or left responses, and actually the solution usually is in the middle. I don't mean that. I'm not a Lib Dem, by the way. So we have to think. We have to think differently, and we have to think about the future of services to the public if we're going to do anything about prosperity. And in order, that means making some hard choices, thinking about things that we haven't thought about before. So productivity across both the public and private sectors, in my view, has got less to do with how hard people work as to whether we understand the services that they're providing to the likes of you and me. And actually, in public services, as in private sector services, there's a lot of failure demand, i.e. demand valueless activity that's created by not doing the right thing for you the first time. Yeah. Now, in the public sector, the response to that has often been things like call centres. By the way, they don't work. They just drive up the wrong sort of demand, generally. And there is some evidence for that, for instance. So I would say that if you want a prosperous society, we need to rethink the relationship between individuals and services to the public. We need a new settlement. And I'm not really interested in the argument about smaller or larger states. I think there's some kind of... I'm more interested in what value the state adds, which is a different question, I think. And I think we ought to be thinking more radically about the relationship between politics and individuals. I'm shocked whenever I know I've got to go to all three party conferences. I'll say this, then I'll shut up. And I'm shocked about how much people who attend party conferences, as party members or not, understand about politics compared to those outside. Young people are disengaged generally, and it's not just young people. People don't understand how the country's run, the country they live in. They don't understand the difference between the House of Lords and the House of Commons, and then they disengage. It's not scepticism, it's cynicism. You've all got a right, in my view, a duty to be sceptical. It's cynicism that kills politics. And we need to be, if we want to be a prosperous society, we need to be re-engaging and educating people in politics, in the idea of it and their involvement in it. Otherwise, we won't have a prosperous society. We'll have one in which those that know benefit, and those that don't. Very simple. That's it.
Thank you. Tim.
Well, thank you very much to the Garton Institute for this invitation. It's a fantastic think tank in the heart of London doing amazing research, and I hope all of you will have a look at this prosperity index because it's such high quality research. And I think the chapter, the theme that I'd like to just briefly focus on, the theme about the importance of social capital to prosperity. And I'm going to try and tell a story now that previously has made me cry most times I've said it, so I will try not to embarrass myself and embarrass you. But it was a retelling of the story of the prodigal son by one of my favourite Christian writers, Philip Yancey. As a girl growing up in a isolated part of Michigan, home life is a bit dull, and one day she just decides she's completely bored with her parents, and she runs away to Michigan. And she finds to Detroit. And she finds, why anyone would run away to Detroit now, I don't know. She runs away to Detroit, falls in with a man who promises her all sorts of nice things, including a penthouse flat. All she has to do is perform tricks for men, and she'll be very well looked after. She lives the highest, most exotic life she could ever think of. Then she falls ill, and this man who looks after her suddenly isn't interested in her anymore. She finds herself on the street, living worse than the dog back in her family home. She's had no contact with her parents. She knows they've been trying to look for her. She saw her face once on a milk carton. But she decides it's time for her to go home. She rings home, gets the answer machine and says, "Mum, Dad, I don't know whether you'll forgive me for what I did, but I'm catching the bus. I'll be at the bus station at 3:50 p.m. If you're there, it would be lovely to see you. If you're not there, I'll just carry on to the next station. And I'm sorry." So as the coach is going to this home bus station, she has no idea whether anyone will be there. Will her parents have even got the message that she left? And nothing prepares her for the scene that greets her at the bus station. Not only are her mum and dad there, but all her relatives. Banners, signs, welcome home, balloons, everything. Why am I telling you this story? I'm telling you this story because there is nothing more powerful in our society than the love of parents and family for their children. And there's a guy in this room, I won't embarrass him by pointing him out, but I was talking to him yesterday. He has worked extraordinary hours, a job that I don't think he's particularly enjoyed for a very long time, to send his daughter to private school. And he told me yesterday that he's now able to stop working because his daughter's got him to a top grammar school for her final 2 years of education, and he can now do the job that he wants to do. Wine tasting, I understand. A job that certainly involves wine tasting. And some people are, sending your children to private schools is almost a sort of a social sin in parts of the country. But actually, the sacrifices that parents make for their children, their education, their well-being, are enormous. And my point is, are we as a society, to use the expression that Victor, the challenge that Victor just laid down to us, are we thinking differently about how we lay the foundations for prosperity? Because although socialism and capitalism are presented as alternatives in large respects, they're also quite similar in some respects, isn't it? They're essentially both materialist philosophies. Capitalism is interested in workers and consumers. The state is interested in benefit claimants and welfare employees. And we have a whole way of public policy where we only measure things like economic growth, like economic capital, and we don't measure the quality of the relationship that I actually think, particularly as conservatives, those of us who are conservatives in this room, we aren't libertarians, we aren't economic individualists, we aren't British, we are conservatives, and we conserve what is best in society. Are we doing that? Is all of this thinking at the heart of our philosophy? Does our government think about how it impacts family life? Does it challenge business to think about how it affects communities when businesses relocate? Because if we don't do this, we are neglecting the most powerful force in society. And if you want to think what is the opposite of the person in this room who looks after his daughter in the way that he has, the opposite of that family in Michigan, think of when the state is a parent. Think about children in care. Think of the life outcomes that they have. No one in their corner, no one trying to get them into the best school, no one reading to them at night, no one going to the extra mile to find the best hospital care. And I'll end by saying, I so much agree with Damien. I think one of the things that this coalition could be proudest of is the Troubled Families Initiative. Conservatives do not get anywhere near enough credit for some of the things that this party does for the poorest people. But I think the one policy idea I would recommend most of all, because otherwise I'm in danger of sounding like I'm just supporting motherhood and apple pie, but motherhood and apple pie is quite good, is houses, home building. If you want to really support the family and you really want to help more people live in quality relationships, again, think about what it's like to live in a cramped home where actually there's too many children to the bed, where people can't read, where they can't study homework, where the parents go to bed at night worrying about the debt that they've had to incur because of the mortgage, or whether they live in private rented accommodation and are constantly having to move, potentially away from work, potentially away from the school where their children have just been settled. I think the housing crisis is not only a massive driver of inequality in our society, but it's also a massive driver of a lot of the social problems and decline in social capital that we have. We want people to be employees, employers, active adults who've had a childhood that is as rich as most of us probably in this room have enjoyed. And if we don't take steps as Conservatives to provide that richness, we will never have firm foundations of prosperity. And I would like to think that Conservatism is the alternative, the relational alternative to the materialism of socialism and capitalism.
Right. We're just over the half an hour for the talk, so we've got about 25 minutes left. I'm going to open the floor to questions. Yes.
Tim and Damien both talked about individual policies that they believe make a very big difference to our country. Sean and Victor both identified the problem but didn't really talk about solutions to it. I was going to ask both of you, you talk about radical, you know, we need a radical policy. If you had choice of just one policy, what would it be?
Well, I mean, you'll forgive me if I actually think that there isn't a single policy initiative that's going to solve this.
If you had the choice, what would be the choice?
I think I said if I had the choice, I would rewrite what we consider to be the contract between individuals and services to the public, as I said.
At the moment,
we have this crazy situation, in my view, where you have a debate between what is public, what is private, what is not for profit in the provision of many of our services. And I think that debate and that construct creates the wrong kind of relationship between individuals and the services that they provide. Let me back that up by talking some work that an organisation I'm involved in called Collaborate did, which talked to thousands of people about their relationship between the services that they get, you know, health, social care, education, and what they actually need. And what they told us was that they're disenfranchised, not engaged, and a lot of the services are not designed to meet their needs, so they don't use them. Or they don't use them until they're in extremis, which wastes money. So, in my view, if you want to increase prosperity, you have to start with some basic assumptions about the relationship between individuals and the services that they receive. That's as far as I'm going to go. I mean, the argument that says that I'm not against the family intervention, but it deals with a small stock. It doesn't deal with the flow. I can tell you now that 1 in 11 children are going to go home this evening to parents that are drinking too much alcohol, and I can draw a line between their lives and ending up either in care, in prison, or unemployed. Family intervention won't help those people because it's not big enough, it's not scaled enough, and it's not universal enough. So in order to fix that problem, we have to redesign what services to the public are doing. And that also speaks to the point that Tim made, I'll just say this and then I'll shut up, about the role of the private sector in that regard. You know, if you've got 30% of the retail market, it's very difficult for us to do without you. You know, if you pull out of a community, everybody suffers. I think beyond a certain point, you actually are in a very privileged position. You're providing a service to the public, and there should be privileges provided to you for that, but I also think you have responsibilities to that community and to the country. And that's a different relationship to the one that we have now, where we consider that if you're the private sector company, regardless of how big you are, you've got nothing to do with the community or the individuals in which you actually preside. That's what I mean. These are about big ideas, not small interventions, I think.
Sure.
One policy I would institute would be building on an existing one, the free schools policy. This is where anybody basically can set up a school in their area and give parents a choice of another school. What I would do with it, though, I would take it in a completely different direction. Rather than have them just sort of pop up willy-nilly, largely in areas where, you know, they may or may not need them, I'd do the analysis of where those areas in the country where the schools are at their worst, where people face the least choice and where there's probably the most poverty, all those things actually interlink. And I would target the free schools in those areas and say, right, anyone can set up a school, don't care if it's Tesco's or it's a church or whatever, right? So outside the state involvement, set up a school, it will compete with others, give parents a free choice of sending their kids there, and, you know, take on these dinosaurs in local government that basically block them for ideological reasons through the planning process. You can ban those through things called local development orders. Won't get too boring and technical, but you can do some really, really strong, powerful stuff if you target policy and resources on the poorest areas. And I think the most transformative thing to do in order to enable prosperity and poverty and the social capital that, that Tim's talking about would be through that school's policy. So, yeah.
Can I just add to that, if I may? Yeah. I think there's a link between the story that you told about the chap who's worked on Our God Sent to send his kid to private school. I can't help pass it, the free school issue and what my wife does. Because we don't live in a poor area and we don't live in a rich area. I think it's kind of aspiring. Now, we could have sent our kid to the private school and we could have, you know, slogged. But, and my wife could have gone to work and done all that stuff. You know what we decided to do? We decided to improve the school that's nearest where we live, which wasn't a very good school. And my wife has spent all hours, God sends, actually improving that school, not just for our kids, but for everyone else's, as opposed to driving past it in order to send our kid to the private school. Now, I think that in that there is a challenge for the education system, which is how do you empower local communities to gain the skills necessary to take ownership and leadership, as opposed to drive past. Do you
understand? What you mean,
yeah. Yeah, that's what we did.
Next, sorry.
My name is Mark Wardley. I work as the senior advisor to the Mayor of London, Boris Johnson. I'd like to come back to the point that Damien was making very well about the success of the National Citizen Service. One of the areas of policy that I work in is with young people, particularly about volunteering. And I've seen the NCS at work. We work with a challenge that sets it in London. And we actually, through the Mayor's support, are now introducing social action programmes to all London schools. So introducing young people to volunteering, you know, in primary school, running right through to secondary school. But one of the things that a lot of people say about the success of NCS is, isn't it a shame that it doesn't reach more people, more young people, that it is quite limited in the numbers that it's reaching. And there's been quite a debate in the sector about whether or not the Conservatives will have the courage, perhaps, or the money, or whatever else is required to actually, in their manifesto, think about saying that National Citizen Service should be attached to the end of the school year, the last year of school, so that every child has the opportunity to do it. 3 weeks where they work in the community, that they set up a volunteering project to learn actually how to work as a team and get an idea off the ground, and to also do a sort of an outdoor activity as well, which is all about leadership and team building. So what do you think the chances are that the Conservatives might actually say, we're not going to call it compulsory, we're just going to say it should be part of the final schooling?
I mean, the very direct answer is I don't know, but I would certainly be keen for something like that to happen. My only caveat would be I would much prefer it to be as organised as much as possible outside the sort of direct purview of the state, of state institutions. That I mean, I've seen in my own constituency it works very well because people who are running voluntary organisations are doing it and they're good at working with teenagers, and so they know how to inspire them and so on. If it became the sort of thing you have to do when otherwise you'd be sort of bunking off during GCSEs or, you know, when you finished your last exam or any of those, you know, those periods in your life where you've just got nothing to do for 3 weeks, which are, you know, a tremendous luxury that you don't realise at the time. I think if you started doing that and saying, right, this is now something that gets in the way, then it would remove the sort of enthusiasm that you get now. But absolutely, I think the principle of spreading it as wide as possible is hugely important.
On that point, I mean, I had this experience because we're obviously getting into schools with our programmes, but we all know that the good schools, snap up all these great initiatives. They're the ones that jump up and say, let's do this, let's do that. It helps our children, whether it's classics or sport or music or whatever it is, or volunteering. The problem is that you cannot get to the children who perhaps would benefit most from these initiatives, because the schools, you know, can't kind of, you know, they just don't have the capacity, or they don't have the leadership.
It's a classic case of the inverse care law. I.e. those people that need the care most tend to get it the least. I actually wrote in Prospects magazine a paper with Professor Howard Williamson some time ago, actually arguing, making the point that we make school compulsory, but we don't make the transition from childhood to adolescence to adulthood compulsory at all. And actually, the poor kids, it's not the poor kids that worry me, actually, because a lot of them end up either not mattering or learning the hard way. It's actually the privileged kids that really worry me. It's the attitudes that some of those kids grow up with, because they end up owning the means of production. So they worry me the most. Actually, I think that you're absolutely spot on. It ought to be compulsory. This is the radicalism. It's not a left or right idea. The role of the state is to set the parameters and the values. I don't care who provides the service, but the role of the state is to say, we care enough about our young people to ensure that that transition into adulthood is actually, there's something there, there's some values-driven support for them, without which you're going to continue to get what you've got, which is those kids that need it the most tend to get it the least. It's not surprising.
I just think that all sounds great. I'm not at all sure about the role of the state is to set values. I don't think that at all. I think it's the role
of the Conservative Party conference.
Yeah,
I'd be shocked if you said anything else.
Yes,
but by definition, the state does. By definition, whether the state does establish the values, it supports certain values. We talk about British values, the values of fairness. Are they not supported by the state?
Are they not?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, they argue that what is the state but a construct of society?
No.
Or vice versa.
It's a construct of society, but yeah, the state, in effect, is
a force of nature,
is something. Well, it is. We give the state the power to compel us to do things for for our wider welfare. But if the state then becomes, let me revert to Oakeshott, as all good conservatives should at this point. If the state becomes an enterprise association and therefore has a purpose and starts setting values, then
Don't get me. Let me be clear. I'm not suggesting that the state owns or controls, but given that it exists, I would wish, I don't care who's in charge of it to support certain values that are reflected in most reasonable people. For instance, the fact that we have a state at the moment, that if you landed from Mars, you would conclude that there are certain young people it cares about and others that it doesn't. I'll refer you to the statistic I gave earlier about 1 in 11 children going home, or the state does have some purpose, and one of them, in my view, is to reflect, establish, look how it does, certain values. Otherwise, it has no. There's no point in the state at all.
Okay, I'm going to move on. At the back there.
It's an interesting debate. I think there, but how do we distribute that money as long as people get it at the point of service and it's free? deliverables in delivering a better stay, a better quality of life, and frankly working less hours, but being more productive.
Tim, do you want to pick up? I'm not quite sure the answer is, but...
No.
Well, you would end up with state control. I mean, that's the very definition of it, isn't it? If primary care was answerable to the Department of Health, God help us. I'd rather primary care was answerable to the community and that the Department of Health had ensured that that happened, that there was a framework within which that happened.
Okay.
There seems to be an argument here that to everybody according to their needs and from everybody according to their ability. I mean, it seems a straight open argument here. Is that what you're pursuing?
Well, I don't know that there's an argument. I think that need and ability have something to do with what people get and what they're able to give, yeah.
Well, it's a classic Marxist.
Well, if you're accusing me of a Marxist, I don't know you, sir, and you don't know me, and I can tell you now I'm certainly not a Marxist.
All right, I'm going to move on. Back there. Yes, sir.
Sorry, it doesn't entirely make the debate on, but I'm just interested in Sean's point saying so the government should intervene and standards are really poor. And now, you know, we're obviously, I'm reading about this the last week, we're in Birmingham this week, and this is very sensitive to so much through the sort of power of local government. How much of that relational piece about rebuilding civic society in the local rather than sort of national, and how do conservatives balance that kind of we've got to do something now and therefore we need to use the might of the state to make it happen with the, in the long term with the relational local capitalism and civic society that works. What do you want to say? I mean, that might just cut through some of this.
The big issue in conservatives' minds, and I was always guilty of this when I worked in for this party, was that you believe in you believe in devolution of responsibility, hopefully down to the individual, but to community as well. You believe in enterprise and making markets and 1,000 flowers blooming, and that's actually the policy direction behind free schools, behind the NCS that you mentioned. Why can't we scale that up? Why can't we get it to the people that need it? These are always the questions that come from that traditional conservative approach, which wants to build civil society by creating freedoms from regulation, creating opportunities for people to provide their own services and all the rest of it. My thinking has evolved to the classics using in social policy, looking at how we make markets. You know, if we want a market to emerge, we don't just go, okay, then let's just leave it alone and let it happen. We do stuff. We create a tax break. We create, you know, yeah, we do things, and then of course we don't want it to always be privileged. We let it then compete when it gets going, and I think there's a social policy version of that, and that's the kind of next stage of conservative thinking. I think to say, well, if we want the NCS to actually get the kids that will really benefit, rather than middle class parents that are actually, you know, got the time and ability to do something, we need to focus our resources. In target areas where there are big problems, and the state does have a role in defining, I agree with Victor, the state does have a role in defining what values we want. If we want more entrepreneurship and enterprise, more social capital, as Tim has been saying, we need to do stuff to make it happen. As a conservative approach, you know, it's not in conflict with a conservative approach to freedom and competition, in my mind. You're making that market, or in this case, social policy, happen, and then hopefully it will bloom and sail off and be wonderful later on.
And I mean, to be practical, I take the point of the gentleman who's now gone, but you know, let's not get too theoretical about this. I think, oddly enough, the health and education debate illustrates what's really difficult, because all the things that you say you want to new schools set up and free schools and so on, you know, the end of that would be an education voucher, that you get, you know, a certain amount of money that you as a parent can spend on your child's education, and you can spend that where you like. That's much more difficult to do in health. I mean, Victor's point, I mean, like Victor, I would much prefer GPs to feel responsible to their own community, and by and large they do, and hate the Department of Health and any kind of interference in them, like anyone who works in the public sector does, or the private sector really. But you can't give people health vouchers, because you don't know, with the best will in the world, how much any of us is going to spend on health. over the next year. You can look at the statistics and you can make predictions and whatever it is, half the money each of us cost the NHS will come in the last year of our life. But on the whole, you don't know when that's going to be. So for all those sorts of reasons, there will have to be different solutions in different sectors, and therefore making practical all the sort of highfalutin ideas we're all having is really difficult. It's why people like Sean have to be employed to be really clever at the centre of government to try and make this philosophy actually work, because it's much easier to be centralist and top-down and just say, right, what we want is good health, therefore we will add X percent to the health budget and tax people more for it. A lifetime of experience around the world tells us that that doesn't work. That healthcare's not that good in countries that organise their healthcare like that. So it's just very, very complicated.
But oddly enough, by the objective principle, people objectively, actually our NHS is reasonably efficient, actually, compared to other health systems. But I would agree very much with Sean. It's not a case of the problem with this stuff is that it's not a case of either or, either state or individual. It's about finding the balance between the two, with a preference for what you might call localism to some degree. But both have a role. I mean, the idea of education or indeed health vouchers may seem very attractive, except when you start thinking about asymmetric knowledge. And I'm no economist, but you end up with those who know gaining and those who don't not gaining. So you have to intervene. Who does intervene? Well, given it's tax dollars funding the whole thing, the state has to intervene. So you end up with a role for the state again. So we need more sophisticated ways of engaging individuals and their communities in designing and delivering a whole range of services which currently are provided by this thing called the state. Now, that's not the same as a big society, by the way, because that seems a blinding glimpse of the obvious. It's actually about redesigning or rethinking the role of services to the public and who is engaged in their design and their delivery and who's accountable for that.
I think one of the most important things about the Troubled Families Initiative that Damien mentioned and this conversation about redesigning the state is, at the moment, the most vulnerable people in society, and the people that the Troubled Families Initiative certainly works with are amongst those, have so many different agencies in the state that they talk to, and none of it was joined up. And so a police officer may know about the family's criminal justice behaviour problem, a teacher in the school may know about the child falling asleep at school in the morning, the health visitor may know something about some of the health problems, but a huge amount of money is spent with all these actors not coordinating. And the great success of the Troubled Families Initiative is someone is in charge of knocking all these heads together to ensure that things are done more quickly in a coordinated way. And redesign of the state has to involve getting out of the silos that departments and Whitehall departments, local government departments are in. And I think, partly involves quite a significant empowerment of the voluntary sector as well, dealing with the asymmetric information problem that Victor mentioned. You can't just have a few people in the state involved in dealing with this silo problem. You need someone to speak up for the community in case that devolution of power to local states is in some way corrupting or enables certain powerful people to abuse that power. So that devolution of power, the end of silos, has to exist alongside a strong voluntary sector dimension.
But it's very important, because I've done this. Local authorities and government have a role of governance which prevents that, what you've just described, from happening. But I can tell you now, in many of the communities that I've worked in, those communities are perfectly capable of designing services which they can be engaged in delivering that would have just as bigger impact and probably a wider impact as anything designed by national or indeed local government in many cases. And I can point you to places where my organisation has done this. The problem is that it often involves transfer of power from the local government or to the individuals, to the community, and the resources necessary to do that. But ask me whether it's possible? Absolutely. One of the mistakes we make in this country is that we assume that that poor people are stupid. They're not. They understand fully a lot more than often the people that are sent into their communities to solve it for them. By the way, the Troubled Families Initiative is fantastic. It is effectively rebirth of Seaborn, but on a much smaller scale. But if we want to get beyond that, we have to re-engage individuals in the design of bespoke services that they understand and therefore use. That's how the NHS started. It wasn't created by the state. It was created by a bunch of people coming together and deciding they didn't want to pay for their GP anymore. They'd design a health cooperative that actually delivered health free at the point of contact, and the government came down to have a look at it, and I, Bevan, and thought, you know what, that's a good idea. Why don't we try and roll that out? Now, that was about power being in the right place.
Right. We're almost out of time, but there's one person I promised that I'd bring at the back there. Last question.
Yeah, Melissa Maynard, East Hampshire District. It all sounds fabulous, but we try very hard to make sure that our services are designed around what our communities want to need. You clearly have more success than we have, but it is really quite difficult to get people who think they have delegated to us the governance of their services and things such like, and then we come back to them and say, you know, help us design them, help us, you know, make this service get the purpose, and you help us. And it's quite different. You'll get the usual suspects, don't get me wrong. There are plenty of people out there who want to be involved, but they're not actually the end user. They're not the service customer. And it's really quite difficult, unless you've got an awful lot of time and a lot of staff and energy, to really engage at grassroots with your customers and get them to focus on helping us design services that work for them, as opposed to those who feel they speak for those communities working with us to design future.
More than happy to have a chat with you about it, but every single thing that you've described there is a problem. It is possible to overcome. I might point out that it is overcome. There are lots of organisations, both in the private sector, particularly in the private sector, who have to do it, otherwise they would have failed. One of the issues that I feel strongly about is that the NHS, being one of the largest consumer-facing organisations in the world, doesn't understand its consumers very well, and it needs to if it's going to be sustainable. But I'm more than happy to take an offline discussion with you about that.
Right. Any last comments? We've got 2 minutes left, so it is just spoken to perhaps Tim, Damien, and then Sean, just some last thoughts.
I think I agree with Victor in the discussion we've had that the state does have values. It may not always choose them deliberately, but everything that the government does has a values implication. So you tax income rather than wealth, for example, and you are making a judgment about what wealth you want to extract money from, what kind of earnings you want to extract money from, and not. And one of the reasons I think we have the property bubble and property system we have at the moment is because we tax income relative to wealth in a wrong way. And if we protect pensioners' incomes, as we are doing now, because pensioners are twice as numerous as young people and twice as likely to vote, and we don't put that money into early intervention, for example, we're saying a very big value judgment. If we put loads of money into childcare for people who get their childcare from formal sources, rather than giving parents an allowance which allow them to choose to have that money for themselves or to invest it in formal childcare, we're making a very big value judgment about what kind of family setup we want most children and parents to live in. So we're making value judgments all the time, we're just often not conscious of those value judgments. And don't to be too repetitive, James, but my fear is at the moment, because we only think in materialist ways as a public policy, as I mentioned, because we only have measures of economic and other performance, we neglect all the relational dimensions, the value judgments that we make.
Damien?
I just want to give a very quick small point about all the things that we've all welcomed: troubled families, national citizen service, and so on. At which point we all start trying to pick holes in them and say, oh yeah, but they're not reaching the right target market. And this is a problem for the British state. Don't let the best be the enemy of the good. It's probably true that all these things are imperfect and they're not big enough. but nevertheless, they're a lot better than what was there before. And so the temptation to say they have failed because they are only servicing middle-class kids or something like that is, I mean, in the case of NCS, that's not true. But even if it were, getting some people to do some good things and that create benefits for society in the future is better than not doing it. So even if a particular public service or voluntary service in this case is not perfect, please don't chuck it out.
Sure.
Final thought, political one, I guess. You know, we've talked about huge problems and the solutions are pretty blindingly obvious. You know, we need more entrepreneurship, enterprise, communities coming together to help provide services, a lot more innovation, basically. The big thing stopping that happening, frankly, is just the way we've always done things. Pretty much our entire public sector is controlled by politically affiliated trade unions. It will be incredibly difficult to make really big change while that's still the case. So I think politically the Conservative Party should look at targeting its resources and its effort on particular problem areas, and most importantly, as Blair did, frankly, when he did things like introduce the private sector into the NHS, he did so in poorer areas where the trade union movement could possibly argue against that change, because if they did, they'd be being immoral. I think we need to replicate that in schools, in welfare, possibly the NCS as well, and that's where we'd start to get some traction and get out of this infantile debate we have at the moment.
Fantastic. I want to thank all of our panellists. That was a really good debate.